Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 247, The Myth of American Innocence, with Barry Spector. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Well, first of all, I want to give a fairly short definition of what I really mean by the myth of American innocence. And as best as I could condense it into a couple of sentences, it is a 400-year series of narratives, novels, songs, children's stories, political rhetoric, sermons, films, advertisements, and so on, that justify American capitalism, racism, imperialism, and environmental destruction by blaming its victims and removing all guilt and responsibility from both its perpetrators and its beneficiaries.
That was the voice of my guest, Barry Spector, discussing the myth of American innocence. This episode is a little different in as much as it's not an interview, but rather a presentation given to a small group of Sonoma County residents in the home of Larry Robinson, my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 6 on psychology and politics. Larry periodically hosts literary and poetry salons in his home, and this particular event was to honor Barry Spector's new book. I had planned to interview Barry, but it turned out to be more convenient to attend the salon and record his remarks. I've edited out some of the comments and questions from the other attendees, and I also, for reasons of time, edited out a large introductory portion about the myth of Dionysus, which is a guiding metaphor throughout Barry's remarkable book. Now, Barry Spector is a Harvard graduate who writes about American history and politics from the perspectives of myth, indigenous traditions, and archetypal psychology. He's published 3 articles in the Jung Journal, Culture and Psyche, and is the author of the 2010 book, Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. Barry and his wife, Maya, have performed in The Great Night of Rumi, Rumi's Caravan, and The Great Night of Soul Poetry here in the Bay Area, regular celebrations of recited poetry and music, and they've done this for many years. These events held in the San Francisco Bay Area attracted audiences in the hundreds. Although not a poet himself, he feels that the revival of spoken poetry and storytelling is a key to cultural renewal. He and Maya also present oral traditions poetry salons at their home and conduct an annual Day of the Dead grief ritual in early November. Bay Area residents are encouraged to email him to get on his mailing list for these events. Barry runs a furniture moving company, but he would rather move your soul. Now, here's the presentation.
In my imagination, indigenous people all across the world, in every culture or in every location in the world, and in a very few places still, have been living in something that I like to call the creative imagination, or I'll think of it as the pagan imagination, animist imagination, where people are still held in great mythic containers, that living myths that really give their lives meaning and connect them to the greater mysteries, and also to the cycles in life whereby they initiate their young people. And these are, there are still a few places in the world where we like to imagine, at least, that there are still remnants of this kind of imagination. What I think is that gradually, over immense periods of time, with the onset of patriarchy, what happened was, in most places, the creative imagination was lost. And what replaced it was what I call two things. One, the paranoid imagination, which pretty much speaks for itself. It's simply characterized by fear. And its opposite, the predatory imagination, which is constantly looking, perceiving the world in terms of what it can take from the world. And both are kind of narcissistic in the sense that they objectify others, they objectify the world, they objectify nature, they especially objectify woman with a capital W and women with a small W. Yeah, in my mind, that's what we have as modern people. We have all kinds of mythologies, and I'll get into that later on, but most of them are not living myths. They're dead-end stories that take us either toward fear or toward an infinite hunger to constantly consume. I've studied so many writers who seem to think they're speaking about Dionysus, and there is no scholarly consensus. More than any other divinity, at least in Greek myth, he's a projection screen for our obsessions. He's been called the god of madness, of spiritual intoxication, of illusion and change, of transformation, of homicidal fury. He's been called the god of gay men. He's been called the god of indestructible life. Others say he symbolizes the revenge of instinct over order. Nietzsche called him the suffering god upon whom all tragic heroes are based, an allegory for the human condition. And they go on and on and on. To me, he is all this and more. To me, he represents the archetype of the other. And the other is what will... To me, the other is an aspect of nature and human nature that is both outside the boundaries of the known, the familiar, and acceptable, but also within, at its very core. To me, he symbolizes the mystery behind the reconciliation of opposites. And so, and because of that, our rational minds can only define him by what he isn't. So Dionysus as the other is my primary image for understanding American myth and history. But back to Greeks, he's called Xenos, X-E-N-O-S, in Greek myth, which translates as stranger or foreigner. But here's the interesting thing. It also translates as guest. So it's the root of our word xenophobia, of course. But if you go to Greece, you'll see hotels that are called Philos Xenia, love of the stranger. So it seems to me that in ancient Greek thought and language, and very likely in many other indigenous languages, there are still remnants of language that express the profound truth that the soul needs the other for its completion. So I've given a lot of thought to this idea of the other. Some of it comes from psychology. Some of it, who knows where it came from. I'm just going to read some of this stuff because, to me, this is really critical in understanding how we, as Americans, and I will acknowledge that in this room and in when I'm speaking of Americans in general, I'm primarily speaking of white Americans. Innocence defines itself in terms of the other. Splitting off aspects of ourselves inconsistent with our self-image, we know who we are because we are not them, because they dress and speak differently, and because they engage in violence, which we do not. They exist on the far side of the line that determines who we are, just as the world exists on the other side of the skin that determines who I am. Othering occurs at the foundation of our Judeo-Christian tradition. The Old Testament encodes Western culture's central myth of collective identity. Large sections of it are essentially narratives that forge Hebrew identity by distinguishing them from their neighbors. Ironically, the other threatens our sense of who we are, even though we've invented him. The other's characteristics live in our shadows, so he is always lesser. Major categories of otherness are race, class, and gender. Crises or periods of social anxiety can force communities to redefine us. Boundaries shift, and so does the image of the other. Americans in particular, due to our Puritan heritage, which I feel is absolutely critical to understand, Americans in particular have always defined the other as those, like Dionysus, who cannot control their impulses. Otherness inspires fear of pollution, but it also fascinates us. What disgusts us reveals what we unconsciously desire. Racists and homophobes are deeply irrationally dependent upon the objects of their prejudice. Their hatred implies its opposite, an inability to rid the mind of obsessions with the other. Intense and detailed fantasies about the other reveal a soul or a nation attempting to know itself. Power elites deliberately determine who is other to justify the social order. Eventually, we believe that the other deserves low status, so we can minimize those occasions when the other might remind us of who we actually are. However, our innate wholeness always threatens to return. This is perhaps one of the essential ideas of archetypal and or all Jungian psychologies, that the soul has this innate urge to know itself. And how do we know ourselves, especially in a culture where the myths have collapsed long ago? One of the few ways that we get the opportunity to know who we are is by understanding who we hate or who we are obsessed with, or sometimes who we love. But it's always who we're projecting parts of ourselves upon. Our innate wholeness always threatens to return. Psychologically speaking, what is repressed never disappears. Mythologically speaking, all residents of the underworld, those who have been banished to the underworld by the gods of the light, whether we're speaking of Greek myth or the Norse gods, those images, those characters who have been banished to the underworld are always threatening to return. To me, othering takes primary modes. The first is exclusionary, making the other as unlike us as possible. The second is incorporative, colonizing and assimilating him, denying him or her their own voice. Together, they create good and bad opposites, like noble savage / barbarian, or Madonna / whore. Here's an interesting aspect of all this. Othering is completely inconsistent. For example, Europeans for centuries projected opposing images upon Jews. Sometimes it was the id figure out of Freud, figures who would sexually pollute Christian blood. Other times it was stingy superego bankers who were unwilling to assimilate. Bigots in our culture see black people, this is interesting to me, black people as both lazy and threatening. Think about it for a second. Lazy and threatening. Richard Nixon warned of both, the forces of totalitarianism and anarchy, unquote. Any demonizing narrative will do. We unconsciously, and this is something I think I've come up with. I haven't read anywhere. I think I've come up with this one. We unconsciously split the other into inner and outer. It's a little tricky speaking it. I'll say it slowly. The inner other and the outer other. The more we define self or community by impermeable boundaries, the more we are obsessed with the other, both without and within the walls. We fear barbarism without, decadence within. Indeed, raising fear of the outer other for the last 10 or 15 years, it's been terrorism, specifically terrorists with dark skins from us, you know, from the Middle East. Raising fear of the outer other inevitably evokes or constellates the inner other. I'll give you an example. We had 5 or 6 years after 9/11 of constant evoking of these images of the terrorist other. Meanwhile, fast forwarding to our time, it seems like people have been barking about immigration for quite some time. I discovered that in the year 2000, American states introduced 1,400 immigration measures. That number exceeded the total of the previous 10 years. So what does that tell us? In my mind, it tells us that we had had several years of obsession with this terrorist other, and after a while, inevitably, we began to evoke someone who was kind of inside the boundaries, these illegal aliens. By the way, Americans, as far as I know, are the only people who use the same word to describe people who come from other nations, extraterrestrial beings. As far as I know, nobody else calls people visiting them alien. You know, but that tells us, that's going to be telling us something about our myths. Both the paranoid and the predatory imaginations depend upon othering as fear of infection or as desire to manipulate. But I want to remind us again what I call the creative, or I've also called it the polytheistic imagination, sees genos, that Greek word, as guest. At some deep, deep level, which we are all trying to connect back to because we know it's there, I call it the indigenous soul. We all have this indigenous soul in our bones. We have memory of it. And it knows that it needs the other for completion. Understood as a dynamic balance between what we conventionally call good and evil, not the victory of good over evil. Both our longing and our prejudices represent an unconscious search for the other, who is our own deepest nature. Genuine communities, even if they rarely exist in the world anymore, except momentarily, would perceive the other not as a threat, but as someone who may have something to contribute. Denying the other, we deny ourselves. So, Joseph Campbell wrote that we've been living in a demythologized world since the 12th century. Now, if you think of what happened in the 12th century, on the one hand, they were building hundreds of great cathedrals to the Virgin Mary all across Europe. At the same time, time after time after time, they were invading the Middle East and slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people. The original outer other. They had the inner other, the Jew, and they had the outer other, the Muslim. So here we are in 2010. So in my mind, the breakdown of myth in Europe began far earlier. I think the Bacchae itself, written approximately 400 BC, is actually speaking about that, among many other themes. There's a lot of themes. I'm just going to mention a couple of them here just so that they get into the room. I may or may not be able to give them anything like their due. In my book, and coming out of thinking about the Bacchae, three great big themes. One, as I've already referred to, the return of the repressed. The second one is initiation. In the story of the Bacchae, Pentheus is killed. And depending on which texts you read that have survived from ancient times, as I alluded to, his head is returned to his body. And that could be an image of initiation. And I have a whole chapter on initiation in the book. It's connected to this theme of the demythologized world, because I'm convinced that everywhere in the indigenous world there were, as I said earlier, myths that held us all together, and rituals connected to those myths that celebrated all of our transitions in life. There's still, as I said, just a few places where there are remnants of initiation. In America, we have all kinds of pseudo-initiations. The third theme, I call it the killing of the children, and it connects the other two, the other themes. I'll just say a word or two about that. In my thinking, over the course of hundreds and hundreds of years, even thousands of years, what began as true initiation of the young men in every culture, and young women had their initiations too, but I don't have time to go there. But what began and lived for perhaps thousands of years as true initiations of the young men, which meant the symbolic death of the youth into what I call the literal killing of the children. So now, for many centuries, we've sent young men off to war with the kind of ill-concealed hatred that comes out as we're sending a boy and we're going to get a man when he comes back. In my mind, we've been sending the youth off, not just off to war, but in all of our practices of raising youth and all of the horrible things that we've done to children over the centuries, that this is began in initiation and degenerated into literal hatred and literal death of the youth. And the youth that survive become the elders who continue the story. So those are the three big themes in the book that I pull out of the Bacchae story. But here I haven't even mentioned American Innocence yet, and you're probably waiting for me to say something about that. I had to make a little diversion just to bring in those other themes. Well, first of all, I want to give a fairly short definition of what I really mean by the myth of American innocence. And as best as I could condense it into a couple of sentences, it is a 400-year series of narratives, novels, songs, children's stories, political rhetoric, sermons, films, advertisements, and so on, that justify American capitalism, racism, imperialism, and environmental destruction by blaming its victims and removing all guilt and responsibility from both its perpetrators and its beneficiaries. That's a tough amount of stuff to get into one sentence. And if anybody needs, I'll do it again.
Please.
Do it again.
A 400-year series of narratives, novels, songs, children's stories, political rhetoric, sermons, films, advertisements, etc., that justify American capitalism, racism, imperialism, and environmental destruction by blaming its victims and removing all guilt and responsibility from both its perpetrators and its beneficiaries. It is subscribed to in deep unconscious ways by almost all Americans. Liberals, no less than conservatives, and I would say especially liberals. I'm gonna push the edge of that, and I hope it provokes you. I would say especially liberal. It is subscribed to in deep unconscious ways by almost all Americans, liberals no less than conservatives. Although empires always fabricate ideologies to rationalize conquest, only Americans justify invasion and genocide with stories of idealism, good intentions, manifest destiny. In other words, this is one of the essential things that separates us from all of the other, in my mind at least, from all of the other empires of history. We have covered up our history and the griefs of our history with stories of opportunity and freedom and new beginnings. I want to say, before I forget, Joseph Campbell spoke of four characteristics of myth, one of which was the mystical. The mystical is what connects us to the great mysteries of life, and at the other end is the sociological level of myth, which are the non-universal stories told by an individual culture and more or less promulgated by the elites of that culture for obvious reasons. And the myth of American innocence is essentially a myth on that level. It's not a living myth in the sense that it comes out of the ground of this earth. The only the only real living myths that come out of this earth are Native American myths. And at the same time, my imagination is that myths don't hold us as intensely and unconsciously as they do simply on that sociological level. That justifies our narrow interpretations of history. My imagination is that a myth as strong as the myth of American innocence, if we eventually are able to tell enough stories and enough poems and enough art and do enough art, that eventually we'll be able to cook this story down to its essence, and that really is about the new start. I mean, despite what people everywhere across the earth know about our history, and they know it far better than we do because they see it played out on their own grounds, despite all that, tens of millions of people continue to want to come here. And it's not just because they perceive, you know, pop culture and money. They perceive the essence of the thing, which is the new start. And that's clearly what the first waves of English, whether they were Puritans in the North or outright capitalist opportunists in the South, that's what they came with. And how are we that different from other people? And that's why I say we overlay our real story with the stories of opportunity and new start. But at the same time, I don't want to say that those are lies, because at the essence, at the real core of this imagery and this story is the potential for the new myth, which is new start, new beginnings. So, the origins of American innocence. What an ambiguous and conflicted mix of crusading moralism, anxious consumerism, cutthroat competition, aggressive practicality, racist brutality, apocalyptic fear, arrogant optimism, cheerful naivete, willful ignorance, celebrity worship, generous goodwill, and rollicking bad taste constitutes our public life. The myth of innocence holds it all together. To understand the sociological power of myth, consider some questions. Why do millions of Americans who support unions, environmental protection, progressive taxation, women's equality, and universal health care continue to vote Republican? Or still believe that Saddam Hussein caused 9/11? Why, with 12,000 nuclear warheads, do we demonize nations that develop their own? Why do most of us assume, wrongly, that well-educated Americans are more anti-war than less-educated people? Why does the American flag appear in front of every public school, at every university commencement speech, at the New York Stock Exchange, auto dealerships, mortuaries, and churches? Why do both civil rights activists and the Ku Klux Klan carry it? Why do we sing the national anthem before ball games? In totalitarian societies, the dictator's version of reality must be obeyed. Americans, however, believe the myths underlying our fascination with innocence. When nearly everyone shares the common mythic language of Americanism, vigorous argument is encouraged, but only within the limits imposed by unstated doctrinal orthodoxy. In reality, the corporate-owned media carefully frame all controversies to minimize real debate. But why did New York Times writers believe that impoverished Sandinistas threatened us? Why do federally subsidized academics believe their odes to free markets? If intellectuals are absolutely convinced of benign American intentions, what can we expect from the rest of us? A mythic framework holds it all together. A new myth. Americans populated their political, religious, and commercial narratives with ancestry, Columbus, the Pilgrims, the Founding Fathers, amplifying their historical experiences into literature until it assumed mythic proportions. Myth and art exerted reciprocal pressure on each other until they shaped our sense of reality. Some use the phrase civic religion or simply Americanism to describe this thing we've created. Hearing these metaphors of national myth through popular culture, we gloss over our troubled history with illusory solutions. We have been telling ourselves these stories about ourselves all our lives. They glide through our dreams so smoothly that even liberals rarely notice how deeply they hold us. Many, for example, lament America's, quote, mistakes, unquote, in Iraq and Afghanistan, yet continue to praise our good intentions. In speaking this way, we may easily, and this is critical, substitute Vietnam, Nicaragua, Cuba, the Philippines, Haiti, Mexico, Chile, Iran, Guatemala, on and on. This is America's creation myth. It sings of people who came seeking freedom, charged with a holy mission to destroy evil, save souls, carve civilization out of darkness, and get rich. Think about it. It's all those elements are in there. In fact, as I was telling somebody yesterday, de Tocqueville, who wrote his famous book about America in the mid-1820s, already by then he was observing that the spirit of self-improvement in American Protestantism and the spirit of self-improvement in American capitalism were so close that he had trouble distinguishing the ministers from the businessmen. And that was, you know, that was a young republic at the time, but it was already deeply ingrained in our thinking, and it goes way back. Biblical myth justified the entire adventure. Columbus called his voyages the Enterprise of Jerusalem, and the pilgrims saw themselves as Israelites, leaving Egypt/England for the New Jerusalem. Unfortunately, however, the Exodus story is intertwined with the original invasion of Palestine. Since God saved us, they reasoned, we have the sacred responsibility, or you could say have license, to seize land, their land. From the start, our stories of domination came packaged in the language of liberation. Everyone had a role to play. Whites were the chosen people, America was the promised land, and Indians were the Philistines. This story was built up over three centuries of preaching, oratory, fiction, poetry, textbooks, films, television, advertisements. Its essence, if you can cook it down to one single phrase, by the way, the American Dream, the phrase American Dream appears in over 700 book titles, but one person who researched them said almost none of them actually define what it means. The reason being, he figured, is that we all assume it already. The American Dream, and it's an image. Nobody ever thinks of defining it because it is so deeply ingrained in our thinking, if not our blood. This particular person came up with just a succinct three-word phrase, anything is possible. Another writer wrote, America was the future, not to be born anything at all. It was an idea formed by unique philosophical ideals. Anything was possible. Let's go back to that for a second. In initiation, as I've come to understand it, the elders, in their wisdom, search the soul of a young person and pull something out, educate. The word education means to pull out, as opposed to instruct, which means to push in. They pull out something absolutely essential in that young person, and they essentially help that person become the one thing he or she was meant to be. In America, we kind of reversed that. We have told the world that you can be anything you want to be. But indigenous cultures don't do that. They see the one thing you're supposed to be. So that's part of our story. And anything is possible. You can be anything you want to be. course, the shadow side of that story, and this comes out of our Puritan heritage, the shadow side of that story is that if you fail at what you try to be, it is your own fault. In fact, there's a place in the book where I quote Jerry Falwell. He says, if you fail, it's your own fault. This is America. Jerry Falwell, at the time our best-known minister. But this is absolutely ingrained in Puritan thinking, which is itself grounded in predestination. I think that writers about America have glossed over our Puritan heritage and have not acknowledged, I think it ought to be acknowledged, how deeply Puritanism really still has a strong hold on our thinking. And when we all more or less at some level agree that failure is not caused by social systems, by social circumstances, but that it's the fault of the individual, it ties in very easily into our willingness to tolerate the exploitations of other people. In fact, I saw a poll result that even I can't believe. Something like 6 out of 7 Americans believe that. That failure is your own fault. That was a diversion from a diversion from a distraction. But this is exactly the way Dionysus would talk about this stuff. He doesn't go in a straight line. Dionysus doesn't throw fastballs. He throws curveballs. Maybe even knuckleballs.
Screwballs.
Screwballs, there you go. Okay. So this idea of, you know, even now TV commercials for the military encourage us to be all you can be. Remember that one a few years ago, be all you can be? The cliche is effective because it hints at purpose, this idea of purpose, which I haven't spoken about. I kind of alluded to a minute ago that in indigenous cultures, I think the notion, they're not so much concerned with enlightenment or escaping this earth. They're concerned with purpose, with the specific purpose that each individual was born to, and which, depending on which mythology you read, forgot between the time he or she left the other world and arrived in this world. The cliche is effective because it hints at purpose. Assuming unlimited opportunity, we can believe anything we want to be. I would suggest that this is a characteristically inflated American misinterpretation of the old teaching that we were born to be one thing, that the task of soul-making is to discover it. So I've spoken just a little bit about the predatory imagination and the paranoid imagination. As I see it, the Puritans brought the paranoid imagination to the New World, and those who settled the southern states, the English aristocrats, who very shortly got quite rich with their plantations, they brought the predatory imagination. And over time, they came together to some extent. Cooperation between northerners and southerners birthed a paradoxical mix of extreme religious and modern enlightenment values. Man was fallen and sinful. Yet he could become whatever he wanted. Indeed, in 1776, for the first time in history, a nation proclaimed the pursuit of happiness as its prime value. Eventually, religion and business merged as they did nowhere else. Without the support of a state religion or centralized Catholicism, and with Protestant churches constantly splitting in schisms, each individual preacher was forced to become an entrepreneur of souls, a salesman, in order to distinguish his church from other churches and increase its membership. Consequently, as I said, a business growth mentality grew within American Protestantism. How about the idea of freedom? Just an essential word when we conjure up the American myth. Opportunity, freedom, new start. Freedom became a holy term that meant all things to all people. Liberty implies release. It also implies the return of the repressed and liberation in both its Marxist and Buddhist meanings. Americans struggled for a while between the difference between what they call positive liberty, the power and resource to act to fulfill one's own potential, and negative liberty, freedom from restraint, what one didn't have to do. Eventually, the two forms of liberty birthed a monster. Freedom became entitlement to do what one wants, regardless of the needs of the community. To liberate is military slang for looting. But when extremes of wealth and poverty did appear, the rich felt little obligation. Belief in predestination survived long after formal Puritanism declined. The myth taught that poverty was one's own fault. The object then as now was to get ahead. Let's stop for a second. What the hell does that mean, to get ahead?
Pentheus.
Really? I mean, to get ahead implies somebody else that needs to be got ahead of. That's, you know, it's one of the essential images of this American dream business. And when I think about this phrase, to get ahead, it brings up a notion that was coined quite early, the self-made man. Each man was free to succeed or fall on his own. By the early 19th century, the first self-help manuals appeared, often written by clergymen, extolling these Protestant virtues of hard work and perseverance necessary for success. If individuals, and let's go to another level here, if individuals were blank slates, despite this sort of vestigial predestination thinking, if Americans insisted that individuals were blank states, the nation had a purpose unique in history. God had chosen it to spread freedom and opportunity. America extrapolated this idea onto world affairs. The nation of individualists became an individual among nations, bringing the good news to others. Generally, without asking permission, and back to our conversation before, although empires always fabricate these ideologies, only Americans justify what we do with our stories of idealism and good intentions. As I see our history and the mythologies that we intertwine with our history, very early on, the Puritans in particular, but all of the English settlers, began to see the Native Americans as the other, and they quickly projected elements that we associate with Dionysus, especially a free-willing, even communal sexuality, connection of the body, the dance, the drum. They projected these characteristics of their own souls that they would not allow into their own consciousness. They projected it onto the Native Americans. And within a few generations had begun to elaborate these stories, which we all carry with us. Back to Joseph Campbell for just a second. In The Hero with a Thousand Faces, he elaborated this theme that he saw in cultures everywhere, the hero myth, which is, as most of you probably know, is very similar in its structure to initiation. It's three parts. A hero hears a call, he leaves his community, and yes, it is a he, most of the time. He endures the trials in the other world. He defeats monsters. He may, in many stories, may find, liberate, and marry the sacred woman. And this is critically important. He returns to his community. That's the third part of it. And gives his gift to the community. In a bigger sense, the very purpose of his going out on his heroic quest is not for him individually, but it's for the community. What I think happened, and here I am arrogantly amending Joseph Campbell with respect and apologies, I think the hero myth is found absolutely everywhere except in America. In America, we evolved something different. It's familiar enough to be superficially like the hero myths, but it's fundamentally different. What happened as early as the beginning, well, the middle of the 17th century, and by the middle of the 18th century, it was absolutely permanently ensconced in our psyche, was what I call, what other writers have called, the American monomyth, as opposed to the monomyth of Campbell. We call it the American monomyth. And the story is very simple, although it's been repeated thousands upon thousands of times. A community which is absolutely innocent, and let's face it, it's a bunch of white people, because this is important. Absolutely innocent is shocked by the appearance of evil from the outside. This innocent community is unable to defend itself through democratic means. And often this dilemma is symbolized by the capture of a young, beautiful woman, as happened in many cases in the 17th and 18th centuries. The community is powerless to defeat this other, which is dark and specifically defined by its racial component and by the violence that it's willing to do against the community. The community is saved by the appearance of another outsider, this enigmatic stranger who rides in from the wilderness, who knows the wilderness because he's lived in the wilderness. And he is willing to sacrifice himself, although oddly enough, he rarely does sacrifice himself. He defeats the racial other, external other, and saves the community and restores innocence to Eden. So in other words, he doesn't start in community, experience the world, and return to community with what he has learned as a gift to the community. He begins outside the community, he restores innocence, and then he leaves. The classic theme, or the classic image, is Shane riding off into the sunset, 1953, I think. It's literally riding off into the sunset. That theme was repeated many, many times. I want to emphasize this business of how this theme is so different from the classic hero myths. This theme, in 1682, the first of a long series of what are called captivity narratives was published, in which a woman who had been captured by the natives and then had lived among them and then escaped and come back to society and told about her stories. For the next 50 years, all but one of the best-selling books in America were captivity narratives. So they were deeply ensconced in our psyche after, you know, four or five generations. Those narratives continue to be told right up to the present day in thousands upon thousands of cowboy and detective stories and superhero stories and science fiction stories, including Star Wars, and they've been enacted, or I should say utilized, to get us into war after war after war. You remember Jessica Lynch, the story of Jessica Lynch justified the invasion of Iraq. These stories of unprovoked, violent capture or invasion or threat of invasion even by the other, by the dark other, are absolutely essential to this myth of American innocence. And it's allowed us to justify, I would say, every war we've ever been in, with the exception of World War II. And we're there right now with Afghanistan because one of the themes of that we utilize when we go to war, it begins with unprovoked attack by the other. It follows with the heroic crusade to save those that the other has attacked. It quickly will morph into stories of bringing democracy to that place. But it's a sequential drama. I mean, Afghanistan, it's being played in Afghanistan very clearly, and it was in Iraq. I mean, we've just allegedly, you know, ended the war in Iraq because we've brought them democracy and so on. Anyways, I think what is obvious is that our leadership enacts our myths for us. And we let them do so because we are so desperate to believe those. Still, ever since, well, since the 60s, cracks in the myth have periodically appeared. And whenever those cracks in the myth appear, intellectuals, their job is literally, I think, to shore up those cracks in the myth. And I think just prior to 9/11, there were serious cracks in the myth. And I'm not going to open up that worms right now. But we all know what happened. We all know what they were writing prior, what those guys were writing prior to 9/11. The myth continues to solidify because it is so deeply ingrained in us. We have our specific American myths. We also have inherited all kinds of broken myths through our European heritage. Most powerful of which, I think, is the killing of the children, in which we've justified everything that we've done to the rest of the world and sending off all of our young men for that reason. I think at a simple psychodynamic level, those who suffer trauma are very likely to either enact it out as adults or inflict it on their own young. The essential thing here is that trauma is part of our heritage going back as far as we want to take it. I think in indigenous worlds, I mean, certainly people experience trauma, they experience tragedy. They're much closer to it in many respects, and they understand death in ways that we as Americans don't want to go to look at. One way in which Americans in particular deny the reality of death and trauma and suffering is because we're so willing to inflict it on other people. In fact, there's a mythic image in there. Hillman talks about Dionysus's half-brother Apollo, who in a sense is almost the exact opposite. He's, you know, as most of you know, he's the god of light, of music, of rationality, of clear thinking, and so on. But among the Greeks themselves, the story is told that Apollo gave up his shrine of Delphi to Dionysus for 3 months of the year. And what tells me is that the Greeks understood, in the most rational culture that had then evolved on the earth, they still understood that they had to carefully, ritually accept chaos and irrationality into their worlds. And they had great big communal rituals to do exactly that. On the one hand, as I said, we're all inheritors of this tradition, going back millennia, of the killing of the children and the violent socialization of children. So we share that with all modern cultures. I think what complicates it for us is our specific heritage, our history of inflicting trauma on, first of all, on the Native Americans. We have not even begun, as we all know, to deal with our heritage of having inflicted genocide on the Native people here and upon the black people that we brought here. And the consequences of that refusal to acknowledge our history as perpetrators is in our bones. I mean, we carry, most of you know Maladoma, I would imagine. When he first came, the shaman from West Africa, he tells the story when he first came to America, and he walked around New York City. He saw thousands upon thousands of ghosts, which were the ungrieved dead of our culture. Every November, we put on our Day of the Dead ritual. And we figure it's our small way of beginning to invite this imagination of this willingness to grieve, not just for our personal losses, but for our communal losses and our communal heritage of trauma, of being perpetrators. And I think perhaps that's, well, again, all cultures, all empires have done that, but some people say that 50 million black people were dislocated from Africa. Only a third of them were actually arrived here as survivors. And we just haven't even begun.
I hope you were stimulated by this presentation by Barry Spector and that you were able to hang in with it despite missing texture added by question and answer format. Barry is a rare bird, an independent thinker operating outside the academic environment. Yet he's written a very thoughtful and, I think, penetrating analysis of the American psyche. As I recall, the book was written over a period of 9 years of research and reflection. It's very hard for books to get publicized and noticed these days. I think this is a book that deserves a wide audience. In my opinion, if it can find that audience, it has the potential to be one of those important milestone books, such as The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit or The Lonely Crowd were some time back. Not sure all of you will be able to remember those two books or got exposed to them, but trust me, they were important some time back. Barry's book does have a foreword by the noted Jungian author Robert Johnson, as well as cover endorsements by Michael Mead and Gene Houston. So the book Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, is available through Amazon.com, among other places. And in addition, Barry's essays can be found on his website, which is www.barryandmayaspector.com. And in case you don't know how to spell that, there will be a link in the show notes on the website.
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long. Just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
I hope you'll be pleased that this is coming out about a week sooner than you might have expected. I've been doing an every other week schedule for some time now, but hey, I had the time, and so why not? You might want to check out my latest Wise Counsel interview with Daniel Strunk, PhD, on cognitive therapy for severe depression, and that's at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. Hey, I have an opportunity to get my own Shrink Wrap Radio iPhone app. This would allow you to stream the show to your iPhone or iPad without having to take up valuable memory space. It would sell for $2.99 US. I don't know if I have enough iListeners out there for it to be worth the effort, though. Drop me a line if this is a development that you'd like to see come to fruition. We have a new ad, by the way, on our Top 10 widget in the right-hand sidebar of the Shrink Wrap Radio homepage. Remember, anyone can purchase one of these little ads for a one-time fee of $20 right on the site, and it will stay up there until 10 more such ads come along and bump it off, which in all likelihood would be quite a long time. So this is one of the best advertising bargains around. So the new link right at the top is to a blog and podcast all about Viktor Frankl's logotherapy, a topic I have yet to cover here. So be sure to check that out, and thanks to that sponsor. Don't forget that we also have a store tab on our site where you can purchase, among other things, 3 archival CDs covering the first 75 episodes of this show. Each of the 3 CDs is just $9.95 plus shipping. In addition, if you need CE units, continuing education, that is, like if you're a social worker, psychologist, psychiatrist, psychiatric nurse, whatever, we have 2 APA accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to selected interviews that I've got up here. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And while you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. I myself have saved money on printer ink at 4inkjets.com, and I'm waiting for my first pair of shoes to arrive from ShoeBuy.com. I'll let you know how those turn out. Be sure to help evangelize about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends, colleagues, fellow students, relatives, and strangers in the street. I know there's a much larger potential listenership than I've been able to get to so far. Also, don't forget to blog and Twitter about your favorite episodes. And thanks to all of you clicking on that big green donate button on our homepage. Both your one-time and your ongoing donations help to keep the fire burning.
Hi, this is Dr. Barry Kraker, director of Maimonides Sleep Arts and Sciences Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and author of the book Sound Sleep, Sound Mind. And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Barry Kraker, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from Peter B. Todd, who you may recall as my guest on episode number 240 when he talked about unconscious mental factors in HIV infection. And Peter writes, "Dear David, attached to this email is the finalized brochure for the symposium at which Jonathan Shedler will be the keynote speaker. The theme of his presentation is provocatively titled, Psychodynamic Therapy is Evidence-Based. I shall be a discussant at the conference, commenting on the central issue of operational analysis and measurement in the verification of psychoanalytic theory and practice. I really wish to acknowledge your valuable contribution through the podcast, especially with Jonathan Shedler and myself in episodes 236 and 240, to raising consciousness in this country about these topics. Through Shrink Wrap Radio, you have helped to turn the tide of opposition to psychoanalysis while creating an intellectual environment for a significant paradigm shift. Please keep up your excellent series. It provides inspiration and encouragement to many people who might otherwise linger in obscurity as scientific heretics. Kindest regards, Peter B. Todd." Thanks, Peter. I'm very pleased to have played some small part in these developments. You may recall that Dr. Jonathan Shedler, the keynote speaker at the upcoming conference, was my guest on episode number 236 on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapies. So I encourage all you Australian listeners to attend this important conference, which is open to all. The conference will be on Saturday, November 13, 2010, in Sydney, Australia. Now, I've put the PDF of the conference flyer with full registration details on our site, and you'll find it under the Promos tab at the shrinkwrapradio.com website. Do take a look. Okay, I think we have time for one more. And it reads, Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Alex, and I wanted to write you a letter to express my deep gratitude for your amazing work with Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm a huge podcast fan and can say without any reservations that your podcast has done more to entertain me, educate me, help me deal with the hurricanes of life, and expand my mind than any other that I've listened to. I live in New York, and podcasts can be a salvation from the throngs of people and the overstimulation. Yours is the best refuge from that storm. I actually sing the, if you want to know the secrets of what makes us tick, you can find out all you need real quick, song out loud sometimes. It's kind of silly. I'm a graduate social work student at New York University, and as I listen to your show, I really feel that I'm professionally as well as personally enriched. You may be interested to know that I just wrote a letter to G. Kwame Scruggs, director of Alchemy Incorporated, as a result of learning about him from your show. The truth is, I started an internship last Friday at Hollywood Hospital, a psychiatric hospital in Queens. I observed two therapy sessions with adolescent boys and realized what can really reach them is myth. I'm a huge fan of Campbell and Jung, another reason I love your show, and I thought, well, maybe I can bring the power of myth to this hospital. I would be very interested to know if you have any suggestions as to what to read and who to talk to in order to do that. I don't know how to drum, but I play guitar, and I know that in many cultures it was stringed instruments that carried myths along. Maybe we can bring that back, right? In any case, again, thank you so much for hosting a great, thought-provoking, mind-expanding show. If you ever come to our shores, it would be my honor to buy you a drink or two. Sincerely, Alex. Alex, thank you so much for that. It's this kind of feedback that really keeps me going, and I look forward to landing on the shores of New York, of Manhattan Island, where actually one of my sons is living and working right now. And I did get back to Alex, and I suggested in particular works of Michael Mead, and that he communicate with Michael and with Kwame Scruggs, as well as with Dana Houck. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where the name is ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Barry Spector for his insights on the myth of American innocence. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Albuquerque-based sleep researcher, therapist, and author Barry Krako, MD. He's got some very interesting and challenging notions for all of you sleepers out there, and not just the insomniacs. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.